The Girl of the Golden West by David Belasco. Chapter 3. The Polka Saloon! How the name stirs the blood and rouses the imagination. No need to be a 49er to picture it all as if there that night. The great high and square room, lighted by candles and the warm yellow light of kerosene lamps. The fireplace with its huge logs blazing and roaring. The faro tables with the little rings of miners around them. And the long pine bar, behind which a typical barkeeper of the period was busily engaged in passing the bottle to the men clamorous for whiskey in which to drink the health of the girl. And the spirit of the place! When and where was there ever such a fine fellowship, transforming, as it unquestionably did, an ordinary saloon into a veritable haven of good cheer for miners weary after a long and often discouraging day in the gulches. In a word, the polka was a marvelous tribute to its girl proprietor's sense of domesticity. Nothing that could ensure the comfort of her patrons was omitted. Nothing, it would seem, could occur that would disturb the harmonious aspect of the scene. But alas, the night was yet young. Now the moment for which not a few of that good-humored and musically inclined company were waiting arrived. Clear above the babel of voices sounded a chord, and the poor old concertina player began singing in a voice that was as wheezy as his instrument. "Camptown ladies, sing this song, doo-dah, doo-dah. Camptown racetrack, 5 miles long, doo-dah, doo-dah day." Throughout the solo, nothing more nerve-wracking or explosive than an occasional hilarious whoop punctuated the melody. For once, at any rate, it seemed likely to go to the distance. But no sooner did the chorus, which had been taken up to a man by the motley crowd, and was rip-roaring along at a great rate, "Gwine, run all night, gwine," reach the second line, than there sounded the reports of a fusillade of gunshots from the direction of the street. The effect was magical. Every voice trailed off into uncertainty, and then ceased. Instantly, the atmosphere became charged with tension. A hush fell upon the room. The joyous light of battle in every eye, if nothing else, attesting the approach of a foe, while all present, after listening contemptuously to a series of wild and unearthly yells which announced an immediate arrival, sprang to their feet and concentrated their glances on the entrance of a saloon through which there presently burst a party of lively boys from the ridge. A psychological moment followed, during which the occupants of the polka saloon glared fiercely at the newcomers, who, needless to say, returned their hostile stares. The chances of war, judging from past performances, far outnumbered those of peace. But, as often happens in affairs of this kind, when neither side is unprepared, the desire for gunplay gave way to mirthless laughter. And presently the hilarious crowd from the rival camp, turning abruptly on their heels, betook themselves en masse into the dance hall. For the briefest of periods there was a look of keen disappointment on the faces of the Cloudy Mountain boys as they gazed upon the receding figures of their sworn enemies. But almost in as little time as it takes to tell it, there was a tumultuous lining up at the bar, the flat surface of which soon resounded with the heavy blows dealt it by the fists of the men desirous of accentuating the rhythm, when roaring out, "Gwine to run all night, gwine to run all day, bet my money on a bobtail nag, somebody bet on the bay." Among those standing at the bar, and looking out of bleared eyes at a flashy lithograph tacked upon the wall, which featured a Spanish woman in short skirts and advertised Española cigarettes, were two miners, one with curly hair and a pink and white complexion, The other, tall, loose-limbed, and good-natured-looking. They were known respectively as Handsome Charlie and Happy Halliday, and had been arguing in a maudlin fashion over the relative merits of Spanish and American beauties. The moment the song was concluded, they banged their glasses significantly on the bar. But since it was an unbroken rule of the house that at the close of the musician's performance he should be rewarded by a drink, which was always passed up to him, they must needs wait. The little barkeeper paid no attention to their demands until he had satisfied the thirst of the old concertina player, who, presently, could be seen drawing aside the bare pelt curtain and passing through the small square opening of the partition which separated the polka saloon from its dance hall. "Not goin', old doodaday, are ye?" The question, almost a bellow, which, needless to say, was unanswered, came from Sonora Slim, who, with his great pal Trinidad Joe, was playing faro at a table on one side of the room. Apparently, both were losing steadily to the dealer, whose chair, placed up against the pine-boarded wall, was slightly raised above the floor. This last individual was as fat and unctuous-looking as his confederate, the lookout, was thin and sneaky. Moreover, he bore the sobriquet of the Sydney Duck, and obviously was from Australia.
"Say, what did the last eight do?" Sonora now asked, turning to the casekeeper.
"Lose."
"Well, let the tail go with the hide," returned Sonora, resignedly.
"And the ace, how many times did it win?" inquired Trinidad.
4 times. Was the casekeeper's answer.
All this time, a full-blooded Indian with long blue-black hair, very thick and oily, had been watching the game with excited eyes. His dress was part Indian and part American, and he wore all kinds of imitation jewelry, including a huge scarf-pin which flashed from his vivid red tie. Furthermore, he possessed a watch, a large brassy-looking article, which he brought out on every possible occasion. When not engaged in helping himself to the dregs that remained in the glasses carelessly left about the room, he was generally to be found squatted down on the floor and playing a solitaire of his own devising. But now he reached over Sonora's shoulder and put some coins on the table in front of the dealer.
"Give Billy Jackrabbit for $2, Mexican chip," he demanded, in a guttural voice.
The Sydney Duck did as requested. While he was shuffling the cards for a new deal, the players beat time with their feet to the music that floated in from the dance hall. The tune seemed to have an unusually exhilarating effect on Happy Halliday, for, letting out a series of whoops, he'd staggered off toward the adjoining room with the evident intention of getting his fill of the music, not forgetting to yell back just before he disappeared, "Root hog or die, boys!" Happy's boisterous exit caused a peculiar expression to appear immediately on Handsome's face, which might be interpreted as one of envy at his friend's exuberant condition. At all events, he proceeded forthwith to order several drinks, gulping them down in rapid succession. Meanwhile, at the faro table, the luck was going decidedly against the boys. In fact, so much so that there was a dangerous note in Sonora's voice when presently he blurted out,
"See here, gambler Sid, you're too lucky."
"You bet,"
approved Trinidad, and then added,
"More chips, Australia!"
But Trinidad's comment, as well as his request, only brought forth the oily smile that the Sydney Duck always smiled when any reference was made to his game. It was his policy to fawn upon all, and never permit himself to think that an insult was intended. So he gathered in Trinidad's money and gave him chips in return.
For some seconds the men played on, without anything disturbing the game, except the loud voice of the caller of the Wheel of Fortune in the dance hall. But the boys were to hear something more in there, besides, "Round goes the wheel!" For all at once there came to their ears the sounds of an altercation, in which it was not difficult to recognize the penetrating voice of Happy Holiday. "Now get, you loafer!" he was saying in tones that left no doubt in the minds of his friends that Happy was hot under the collar over something. A shot followed. "Missed, by the Lord Harry!" ejaculated Happy, deeply humiliated at his failure to increase the mortuary record of the camp. The incident, however, passed unnoticed by the faro players. Not a man within sound of the shot, for that matter, inquired what the trouble was about. And even Nick, picking up his tray filled with glasses and bottle, walked straightway into the dance hall, looking as if the matter was not worth a moment's thought. At Nick's going, the Indian's face brightened. It gave him the opportunity for which he had been waiting. Nobly he maintained his reputation as a thief by quietly going behind the bar and lifting from a box 4 cigars, which he stowed away in his pockets. But even that apparently did not satisfy him, for when he espied the butt of a cigar flung into the sawdust on the floor by a man who had just come in, he picked it up before squatting down again to resume his card-playing. The newcomer, a man of, say, 40 years, came slowly into the room without a word of salutation to anyone. In common with his fellow miners, he wore a flannel shirt and boots. The latter gave every evidence of age, as did his clothes, which nevertheless were neat. His face wore a mild, gentle look, and would have said that he was companionable enough. Yet it was impossible not to see that he was not willingly seeking the cheer of the saloon, but came there solely because he had no other place to go. In a word, he had every appearance of a man down on his luck. Men were continually coming in and going out, but no one paid the slightest attention to him, even though a succession of audible sighs escaped his lips. At length he went over to the counter and took a sheet or two of the paper, which was kept there for the few who desired to write home, a quill pen and ink, and picking up a small wooden box, he seated himself upon it before a desk which had been built from a rude packing-case, and began wearily and laboriously to write. "The Lone Star now rises!" It was the stentorian voice of the caller of the Wheel of Fortune. One would have thought that the sound would have had the effect of a thunderclap upon the figure at the desk, but he gave no sign whatever of having heard it, nor did he see the suspicious glance which Nick, entering at that moment, shot at Billy Jackrabbit, who was stealing noiselessly toward the dance hall, where the hoops were becoming so frequent, and evincing such exuberance of spirits, that the ubiquitous, if generally unconcerned, Nick felt it incumbent to give an explanation of them.
"Boys from the ridge cutting up a bit," he tendered apologetically,
and took up a position at the end of the bar where he could command a view of both rooms. As a partial acknowledgment that he had heard Nick's communication, Sonora turned round slightly in his seat at the faro table and shot a glance toward the dance hall. Contempt showed on his rugged features when he turned round again and addressed the stocky little man sitting at his elbow.
"Well, I don't dance with men for partners. When I chasse, Trin, I want a feminine piece of flesh and blood," he sneered, and then went on to amplify, "with garters on." "You bet," agreed his faithful if laconic pal, on feeling the other's playful dig in his ribs.
The subject of men dancing together was a never-ceasing topic of conversation between these two cronies.
But whatever the attitude of others, Sonora knew that Trinidad would never fail him when it came to nice discriminations of this sort. His reference to an article of feminine apparel, however, was responsible for his recalling the fact that he had not, as yet, received his daily assurance from the presiding genius of the bar that he stood well in the estimation of the only lady in the camp. Therefore, leaving the table, he went over to Nick and whispered,
"Has the girl said anything about me today, Nick?"
Now, the role of confidential adviser to the boys was not a new one to the barkeeper, nor was anyone in the camp more familiar than he with their good qualities as well as their failings. Every morning before going to work in the placers, it was their custom to stop in at the Polka for their first drink, which was generally on the house. Invariably, Nick received them in his shirt sleeves. For that matter, he was the proud possessor of the sole biled shirt in the camp. And what with his red flannel undershirt that extended far below the line of his cuffs, his brilliantly colored waistcoat and tie, and his hair combed down very low in a cowlick over his forehead, he was indeed an odd little figure of a man, as he listened patiently to the boys' grievances and doled out sympathy to them. On the other hand, absolutely devoted to the fair proprietress of the saloon, though solely in the character of a good comrade, he never ceased trying to advance her interests. And since one and all of her customers believed themselves to be in love with her, one of his most successful methods was to flatter each one in turn into thinking that he had made a tremendous impression upon her. It was not a difficult thing to do, inasmuch as long custom and repetition had made him an adept at highly colored lying.
"Well, you got the first chance,"
asseverated Nick, dropping his voice to a whisper. Sonora grinned from ear to ear. He expanded his broad chest and held his head proudly, and waving his hand in lordly fashion, he sung out,
"Cigars for all hands, and drinks too, Nick!"
The genial prevaricator could scarcely restrain himself from laughing outright as he watched the other return to his place at the faro table. And when, in due course, he served the concoctions and passed around the high-priced cigars, there was a smile on his face which said as plainly as spoken that Sonora was not the only person present that had reason to be pleased with himself. Then occurred one of those terpsichorean performances which never failed to shock old Sonora's sense of the fitness of things. For the next moment, two ridge boys, dancing together, waltzed through the opening between the two rooms, and, letting out ear-piercing whoops with every rotation, "Oh! Ho-ho!" whirled round and round the room till they brought up against the bar, where they breathlessly called for drinks. An angry lull fell upon the room. The card game stopped. However, before anyone seated there could give vent to his resentment at this boisterous intrusion of the men from the rival camp, the smooth, oily, and inviting voice of the unprincipled Sydney Duck, scenting easy prey because of their inebriated condition, called out in his Cockney accent,
"Hello, boys! How's things at the Ridge?"
"Wipes this camp off the earth!"
returned a voice that was provocative in the extreme. A reply that instantly brought every man at the faro table to his feet. For a time, at least, it seemed as if the boys from the Ridge would get the trouble they were looking for. A murmur of angry amazement arose, while Sonora, his watery blue eyes glinting, followed up his explosive, "What?" with a suggestive movement towards his hip. But quick as he was, Nick was still quicker, and had the Ridge boy, as well as Sonora, covered before their hands had even reached their guns.
"You!"
The little barkeeper's sentence was bristled out, and contained, along with the expletives, some comparatively mild words which gave the would-be combatants to understand that any such foolishness would not be tolerated in the polka unless he himself
allowed it to be necessary.
Not unnaturally, the Ridge boys failed to see anything offensive in language that had a gun behind it, and realizing the futility of any further attempt to get away with a successful disturbance, they wisely yielded to superior quickness at the draw. With a whoop of resignation, they rushed back to the dance hall, where the voice of the caller was exhorting the gents, whose partners were mostly big, husky, hairy-faced men, clumsily enacting parts generally assigned to members of the gentler sex, to swing. "With the right-hand gent, first partner swing with the left-hand gent, first partner swing with the right-hand gent, first partner swing with the left-hand gent, and the partner in the center, and gents all around." Back at the faro table now, the incident having passed quickly into oblivion, Sonora called to the dealer for a slug's worth of chips, a request that was promptly acceded to. But they had played only a few minutes when a thin and somewhat sweet tenor voice was heard singing. End of part 1 of chapter 3.